Welcome to The Spot, KALW's weekly space for the best in public radio podcasts and storytelling. I'm your host, Ashley Ann Krigbaum. Orbital Path with Michelle Thaller is a podcast that continually stokes my imagination with the big questions its producers highlight about contemporary space research and the variety of voices they bring on to help find the answers. It's a great listen for anyone who wants to be a bit more inspired about the unknown places that science and math can take us to. In this episode, they speak with a scientist who's making a map of our skies by using infrared, measuring the heat and light that comes to Earth from space. She shares some of the most exciting discoveries she's found so far, and just how physically difficult it can be to do the research that she does in some of the coldest places on Earth. I hope you packed your coat.
I'm Dr. Michelle Thaller, and this is Orbital Path, a show from PRX about the cosmos and our place in it. If I were to take a telescope out into my backyard, well, for one thing, I don't have a very good horizon. I live in the woods, and I live pretty close to a city, so there's lots of lights in the sky. So the only things I would be able to see are pretty run-of-the-mill, bright stars and planets. It amazes me how much the sky changes as you move to more and more remote locations. I've been on top of mountains in Chile, where there was no light around, and the sky looked like something from another planet. If you want to see the most dramatic, the most rare objects in the sky, you need to go to some pretty extreme places. And there is nowhere on Earth more extreme or more remote than Antarctica.
In 2003, I was invited as a visiting astronomer to go to this very unique high-altitude place called Dome C, run by the French and Italian communities.
That's Anna Moore. She's a research scientist and instrument designer in experimental astrophysics at Caltech. Now, there are different kinds of astronomers. Some astronomers take the data from telescopes and they make discoveries and they study the universe. And then there are other astronomers that specialize in building the instruments and the new telescopes. And that's what Anna does, and this is really cool. She's always using new technology to make the best new observations, things that weren't possible maybe even just a year ago. Anna has designed cutting-edge instruments that are being used all over the world, in places like Hawaii, California, and Australia. And these all sound like pretty wonderful, warm places that you'd actually want to visit. But then there's Antarctica. According to Anna, being at the bottom of the world isn't quite what you think it would be.
Most people think Antarctica is a hurricane, sort of extremely cold, inhospitable place full of penguins and walruses and stuff like that. And while that's partly true on the coast, there's a very thick, high ice shelf that covers most of Antarctica. And by the time you get inland, you're able to be up at an altitude of about 4,000 meters. In fact, the highest point on the Antarctic plateau is 4,200 meters, which is called Dome A. So not only do you have a constant winter for about 5 months, you also have a very high altitude and you have very cold atmosphere above you. And when you combine all those things, you get a very unique place to do astronomy from for a whole different set of wavelengths. And that's why we go there, purely for science.
And it is in this remote place that Anna has been working on a whole new kind of astronomy, the dynamic infrared.
That sounds very ominous, but it's an area of astronomy that is up until now very difficult to do. And what we want to do is to look at the whole sky, the whole hemisphere, every 2 hours, so basically very quickly, and then get a map of that sky in its infrared wavelengths, and then be able to go back over and over and over again throughout the entire winter season. And we're looking for things that vary, things that change, things that come into existence and then disappear again at infrared wavelengths.
When you think about infrared light, this is the same sort of thing as heat radiation. It's what our skin interprets as warmth. And what better place to study heat light than somewhere that's very cold, where you can make a measurement of any heat that actually gets to you from space. You sit in the Antarctic winter, where it's dark for months at a time, and things change. There are stars exploding, there are stars colliding together, and this creates heat, heat that you can actually sense many hundreds or thousands of light years away, sitting in the Antarctic night. So Anna builds very specialized instruments that can look at the entire sky every 2 hours, and a part of the sky that was cold and dark just a few hours ago suddenly lights up. You may have discovered something really dramatic, like colliding stars or even a supernova.
These are the deaths of stars. These are violent explosions. So these are transient events that they're quite rare, and you need to be able to survey a large area of the sky many times to be able just to detect these things in the first place. And so you learn so much about new areas of astronomy, new physical processes, new events, if you're able to monitor the sky, not just do a one survey, but monitor it every few hours constantly. It opens up whole new areas. And this is the supernovae, the stellar mergers. This is the violent end of the science that we want to do. And I find that really exciting.
Studying these violent and dramatic stellar explosions is fascinating, but there's a practical consideration. To do the sort of work Anna does, you actually need to physically get to Antarctica. And while Anna's been there a handful of times, you pretty much never forget your first trip to Antarctica.
So I was issued a plane ticket to go from Australia at the time to New Zealand. And then we got all kitted up with our winter gear and sat around waiting for a C-130, which is a Hercules, a military aircraft, to take us down to the coast. And when I stepped off the plane, it was really it was an amazing experience. Even on the runway, the ice was a very clear blue color. I'd never seen that before, which was really amazing. And there were also there were walruses in the distance that I could see. This was really just stepping off the plane straight away. So that was really cool.
So even after this long flight from New Zealand, Anna did not have much time to get acquainted with the locals. She was right off again.
So 2 hours later, we took a much smaller prop plane, a propeller plane, which then took us on a four-hour journey from the coast of Antarctica inland to the Dome Sea base. And when we got off the plane there, you immediately felt the altitude. And I'm used to altitude. I am an astronomer, so I am used to it. But when you combine that with the cold and the dryness of the site, you actually get quite a strong headache for about 3 days. That doesn't really go away. And so you kind of have to get used to that. But then after a few days, your body gets acclimatized and you feel okay.
Anna was now in a place that very, very few humans have ever had the ability to go to, the high Antarctic plateau.
It's very still, incredibly quiet. No smells. It's ice as far as you can see to the horizon. You fly in during the summer, so there's no night. The sun is up constantly. So it's the most bluest of blue skies, zero cloud, and actually feels quite warm, which I was surprised at, because the thermometer is showing minus 30 or minus 40. But because the sun is up and the ice is very reflective, you actually feel quite warm as you walk around. I was quite surprised about that.
The image of my friend Anna walking around on Dome Sea feeling warm seems absolutely crazy. I mean, let's calibrate a little bit. This is at an altitude of about 11,000 feet, and the temperatures are a little bit below 20 below zero Fahrenheit. So incredibly, Anna was comfortable, but when you think about it, this place is run by the Europeans, and Europeans know a thing or two about staying comfortable.
Inside, they had the most amazing Illy coffee machine I have ever seen, and I was not even allowed to go near it because I was British and therefore deemed not educated enough to be able to operate an Italian Illy coffee machine. And so I was made one of the best coffees I've ever had after landing, which was quite amazing.
So it turns out Antarctica was not as desolate a place as you might imagine. Here they are having wonderful coffee, and there's a Michelin-rated French chef there. But it's not really that that makes it a warm place.
Antarctic astronomy and deployment there is very different. You're very close, much closer than if you were putting an instrument on a telescope at a temperate site like Palomar or something. And, you know, you're going through this adventure together, and sometimes for the first time for some people. And you get, you know, you get through the altitude sickness, and then you, when you're over that, you know, you're unpacking an instrument, debugging it, and, you know, making sure it all works. And you're really made to feel a close member of that community when you're there. You're in the middle of nowhere, and everything just has to work, and, you know, your very lives kind of depend on it. And so it's a truly bonding experience.
Anna's instrument is able to detect changes in the infrared sky, but those changes can come from many different things. For example, sometimes it's just a single star that's changing.
You can do amazing things with cool stars.
And by cool stars, we mean stars where the surface temperature is lower than the sun. The sun's surface temperature is about 10,000 degrees Fahrenheit, so we're talking maybe 4,000 degrees.
Things that are called brown dwarfs that are essentially failed stars. And we know they're there. We know there are many, many of these stars in the universe, in our galaxy. And it's just very hard to find them because they just don't emit much radiation, but they are very bright in the infrared. And we'll be able to do things like monitor weather on such objects. We'll be able to maybe even detect transits around such stars with an instrument like this.
And by transits, she means things that are orbiting around these brown dwarf stars, actually blocking out a little bit of the infrared light. A good analogy would be Jupiter with its systems of moons. As the moons move back and forth across Jupiter, they block a little bit out. In a real way, we're observing moons around big Jupiters in space. The work that Anna has been doing in Antarctica has actually yielded wonderful scientific results. We've discovered things about stars, these giant planets called brown dwarfs. But now Anna thinks she might be hot on the trail of something really new, discovering violent explosions that may create some of the elements around us.
One of the most exciting science cases for a new proposal that we have for Antarctica is to try and discover where all elements that are fancily called our process elements, but elements like gold and platinum that we kind of take for granted here are amazing elements and how they're formed. And it turns out that they formed, we think, in the center of stars. And some other much more violent, much more energetic event causes these elements to produce and to be formed. And one of the leading contenders is a neutron star-neutron star merger.
For a long time, scientists have believed that all of the chemical elements heavier than iron come from a supernova explosion, a single star blowing itself up when it dies. But when you actually run the physics, it doesn't seem to work. You seem to need even more energy than a supernova. And we were sort of back to the drawing board. What could possibly have more energy than a supernova? Well, there's a dead core of a star called a neutron star. Neutron stars are some of the weirdest and most dramatic things in the universe. They're so dense that if you had a cubic centimeter about the size of a key on a keyboard, if you had that volume of neutron star material, it would have as much mass as the entirety of Mount Everest compressed into that tiny little volume. Seriously, Mount Everest per key on your keyboard. You take two 10-mile-across balls of this stuff, those are two neutron stars, and you smash them together. And you get even more energy than a supernova. Anna thinks that using her instruments could actually prove that some of the elements around you right now, not even all that uncommon, things that are in your jewelry, in your electronics, might have come from this sort of extremely violent explosion.
It's possible that if we can discover these events going off with our instrument from Antarctica, and if we can discover that and then alert all the other larger telescopes in the world to be able to follow this signature up and be able to take a single spectrum of it, we will be able to see whether these everyday elements, well, gold is everyday, I'm not sure about platinum, but gold and platinum, will be able to say how they are formed in the universe, where the minds of these elements are in the universe, which is currently unknown. I find that just an amazing reason to get up and come into work every single day.
the science really gets at the core of what I find most compelling about astronomy, that things around you that are actually not that uncommon. You know, do you have a gold ring on your finger right now? You know, are you using a smartphone that has some, you know, heavy metals in the electronics? These things come from unimaginably dramatic sources. Two neutron stars colliding is an explosion so violent that you can detect the heat from it over millions of light years. Millions of light years, each light year being about 6 trillion miles, and you can make a detector, take it to Antarctica, and actually measure the heat from these things. And that's, to some extent, where all of the elements in your body come from. They come from very violent origins, either the Big Bang or a supernova. But Anna's on to a really fun new piece of the puzzle, that there are different things around you that come from something special, a special type of explosion that only happens when two unimaginably weird neutron stars collide and obliterate each other. So that's why we go to these remote places. We are filling in little bit by little bit the story of how the universe came to be, the story how you came to be, how the very atoms that are in you right now started. And that's worth going to some pretty out-of-the-way places for.
This mission to the stars has been commanded by Lauren Ober. John Barth and Genevieve Sponsler co-piloted from the PRX mothership. Erica Kramer navigated the soundscape, and Jim Briggs orchestrated the theme music. Course correction by Andrea Mustaine. Special thanks to the studios of WAMU in Washington, D.C., Planet Earth. We are supported by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, enhancing public understanding of science, technology, and economic performance. More information at sloan.org. And I'm Dr. Michelle Thaler, a little bit of dead stardust, signing off for now.
Welcome back to Earth. You're tuned to The Spot, KALW's weekly space for the best in public radio podcasts and storytelling. I'm your host, Ashley Ann Krigbaum. Now that we're back, go ahead and feel the ground beneath your feet. The sun is out, clouds are in the sky. Maybe you can even smell your favorite floral fragrance that's in bloom this time of year. What's the name of the plant? If you don't know, that's all right. Think about the shape of it. Are the leaves short and stubby, or long and sleek? Now keep that image of the plant and its scent with you. Press it into the pages of a book and place it back on the shelf in the library located deep within your memory palace.
This is the Memory Palace. I'm Nate DeMeo. There's only one dramatic moment in this story. It will come about halfway through. The protagonist, the heroine, will fall from a cliff, and it might seem like the turning point, like the moment where everything hangs in the balance and everything's about to change. But it's not. That point will come earlier, just a few minutes from now. I'll flag it so you don't miss it. And we'll examine it for a second before sliding it into a drawer and moving on. And maybe we'll come back to it at the end, or maybe not. But we'll know it's still there in the drawer if either of us wants to return to it in the future. I'll make sure to leave it unlocked. This story starts here, in earnest, 44 seconds in, with the birth of Inez Enriqueta Julieta Mexia, in Washington, D.C. in 1870. Her father was a Mexican diplomat. Her mother was a socialite from Philadelphia. And when she was three, they all moved to Texas, outside Waco, where Inez spent most of her time alone. She liked it for the most part, exploring the ranch where they lived, picking flowers, watching birds circling above the low hills. Rabbits dart in and out of the mesquite in the Guajillo. Green branches dappled pale yellow all spring. But then her parents split up when she was nine. Her dad went home to Mexico City, her mom to Philadelphia. She put Inez in a private school in the city, then a boarding school in Toronto. Inez was unhappy. And when she was 15, she went to live with her father. She wouldn't see him a lot, at dinner sometimes. She liked him well enough, if not his succession of mistresses. Inez took care of the ranch for 10 years, and then her father when he took ill. She agreed to marry a man who worked in the property, though there was little love there. An intimacy of all types was never easy for the two of them. And then her husband died just a few years into the marriage. And her father, too, right after that. And she was lost and alone and thought of becoming a nun. She was devout, and it made a certain sense, but Her father's will forbade it if she wanted her inheritance, and so she didn't become a nun, and life went on. Went on alone, with her managing the ranch and letting days pass, years. She married again when she was 38 to a Mexican man who was 22, and it never really worked. She blamed herself, it seems. She was too internal, she thought, too in her own head, and too sad. It just built and built. If this were today, and weren't 100 years ago, there would be a name for what she was going through. Some system of classification she could use to identify what she was feeling. Maybe point toward a way out. But it was 1909, and she didn't have a word like depression that she could get her arms around. She just felt guilty and broken. There was no diagnosis someone could give her husband. It would help give him some guidance, give him something, when he just wanted to help. Just wanted to understand why she was always curled up on the top of the covers of her bed, as the afternoon sun came in hot through the window. They didn't call it a nervous breakdown then, or a time-limited episode of mental duress, or acute adjustment disorder with mixed anxiety and depressed mood. They just knew something had to change. And her doctor suggested she leave Mexico. There was someone in San Francisco who might help her. The move broke up her marriage, though not at first. But her husband didn't speak English and couldn't find work, and in the clear light, the kind you get up there when the mist burns off as the day goes on. What were they doing together anyway? And so Inez was on her own in the East Bay, in the care of a Dr. Philip Brown. This was a time when psychology was new, and psychologists were just fumbling around at best. At worst, they were barbaric. But I can tell you with no small sense of relief that that wasn't Inez's story. Her doctor was just improvising, essentially, like the rest of them at the time. But he was guided by kindness, and curiosity, and empathy, and all those things one would want their doctor to be. And he worked with Inez for years, helped her through the disillusion of her second marriage, helped her find some balance. And he did what anyone, a therapist, a friend, an inspirational Facebook meme, might do now. He told her to get out and meet people. Join a club. Take a class. She was 50. Her life hadn't been happy. But it didn't have to stay that way. She started hiking in the Redwoods with the Sierra Club. Made some friends. She'd go to Golden Gate Park and bring a picnic and a book. Sit out in the breeze for hours. She remembered how much she loved nature. She joined this group to save the sequoias. There were meetings. She'd see people at the meetings, and that was nice. She took the trolley up Telegraph to Berkeley one day to see if she could audit some classes, and someone at the registrar's office told her that they had a program for older students. She enrolled at 51, wanting to study the natural world, paleontology, animal sciences, things like that. And she loved plants, so she enrolled in a seminar about collecting and cataloging botanical specimens. And this is it. This is the dramatic moment. The turning point in the story here at 5 minutes and 38 seconds. The part at the cliff is still coming, but we're pausing here because this is the moment that matters. And this is all you're going to get in terms of drama. Just a 51-year-old lady signing up for a class that will teach her how to press flowers and how to put the glue on the little strips of fabric so you can stick the plants to the white paper. Just a middle-aged person whose life had been little but long, marked by years of the kind of sadness and disappointments and loneliness and failed and misguided relationships that cling like nettles, and at some point you stop bothering to pick them off. And then this person at 51 years old finds something she truly loves. And this is the thing, and it is always the thing. She does it. Inez Mexia, 4 years later at 55, then expert in spotting and identifying, cutting, drying, and cataloging botanical samples for academic study, embarked on a solo expedition to the foothills of the Sierra Madre Mountains, east of Mazatlan, Mexico. She hired a guide. She spoke fluent Spanish. Two failed marriages to Mexican men had given her that, at least. And she hiked and canoed and rode on horseback. She slept in tents, slept in the open air under the stars. And she'd stopped to cut flowers, reached to clip leaves from high branches, collect the seed pods of shade trees that would snow in the desert, catch the air and soar and dip, and rise on some unseen current and disappear. She'd dry them and press them, describe where they were found and label them, and send them off, one set to Berkeley, one to Harvard, one to the herbarium at the Royal Botanical Gardens in London, and other places. She had made deals before she left. They'd pay her 20 cents per specimen. And one day she was in the mountains and she spotted a plant she'd never seen before. Maybe something wholly new, something yet unclassified, growing out from a crack at the edge of a cliff. And she crawled toward it out over the valley and reached and fell, as you know already. But there were plants below her that broke her fall and saved her, as seems appropriate. And she broke some ribs and hurt her hand, and she had to go back home early, and that was the extent of it. She had collected fewer plants than she had hoped. But she had hiked the Sierra Madre Mountains at 55. And she had loved it. She loved it. And so she returned, and returned again, to Mexico, barefoot in the reeds and salt marshes in Esquinapa de Higaldo, in the back of a dugout canoe on a night lit only by fireflies blinking on the banks of the Grijalva, to Panama through the canal, to Ecuador and Peru and Brazil up the Amazon, to Alaska, to the Andes, to Tierra del Fuego, and then home to Berkeley. When she was 68 and losing weight. And her friends, there were so many of them, from the university, from the Sierra Club, were there for her as she died, from lung cancer in the July of 1938. She'd been diagnosed just a month before. In the 18 years of her life after she took that class, and after she'd found that thing at 55 that filled her, and then went and did that thing, she collected more than 150,000 specimens. She found over 500 new species and one new genus of flowering asters, now called Mexianthus mexicanus, named after her and after the place she once left behind when her life fell apart and then returned to again and again. And those plants are still with us, in drawers mostly, in herbariums, old museums, the basements of botanical societies, dried and preserved, labeled and meticulously cataloged, glued just so to white pages now yellowed with age, as she had learned to do in a classroom at the age of 52. Each one of them, each flower she saw poke out of the dirt and said that one, each leaf she had stood on tiptoes to take, each blade of grass she had pulled from the hillside with her fingertips, is a moment in her life. And a choice she made.
The Memory Palace is a historical podcast produced by Nate DeMayo. Listen to the show's back catalogs at thememorypalace.us and subscribe to the show on iTunes, Stitcher, and wherever else you listen to podcasts.
You're trying my patience, try pink carnations, red roses, and yellow daffodils. Don't forget the flowers someday, I know you will.
That's it for today's episode of The Spot. You can find this episode and many, many more at kalw.org. Just look for The Spot under the Programs tab. And if there's a podcast you've just discovered and can't wait to share it with someone, go ahead and tell me about it. Email me at thespot@kalw.org. I'm Ashley Ann Krigbaum, and thanks for listening. Tune in next week, same day, same time, for another episode of The Spot, only on 91.7 KALW San Francisco.